This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In April, a court in Toronto found Johnson Aziga guilty of murder and aggravated assault for infecting women with HIV. Aziga continued to have unprotected sex after he'd been repeatedly warned that he carried the virus. When asked by his sex partners, he lied. Two women died. Seven others are now infected. The Canadian case marks the first time that anyone has been convicted of murder by using HIV. But only the murder part is new. More and more charges are being brought against people with HIV who infect or risk infecting others. That includes civil lawsuits based on failure to disclose and charges of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Again, that weapon, bodily fluid. So is there an apt analogy to poison, or is the criminalization of HIV counterproductive? And when consensual sex is involved, do both partners bear responsibility? We especially want to hear from those of you with HIV. What's your experience? Do you fully disclose your status with every partner every time? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the hour, the Thought Police are retirement age. It's the 60th anniversary of George Orwell's classic 1984. But first, reporter John Wells joins us from Hamilton, Ontario. He interviewed Johnson Aziga in prison and wrote about the case for the Hamilton Spectator. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
And is there any doubt that Johnson Aziga knew that he was HIV positive?
No, there's no doubt about that at all. He was diagnosed back in 1996, and a few years after that, he started sleeping with many women, and certainly knew of his status, and openly lied to all of the women that he was in fact positive. And you know, by all accounts, certainly the women for whom the charges were brought against him for, they all asked him if he'd been tested, and he said he had, and that he had tested negative.
And what was his defense?
His defense was all over the map in court. I mean, his lawyers tried to make the argument that perhaps he lacked judgment because of his past experiences. He was from Uganda originally, where he claimed to have seen some atrocities and people murdered and that sort of thing, or at least was in a culture where he heard of that so often that had traumatized him in some way that it affected his judgment later in life. You know, there wasn't much of a defense. I mean, he certainly didn't ever make a claim that he didn't know he was positive. And I guess the issue for the jury was whether or not he showed intent to kill these two women who died. And in the end, the Crown, that the prosecutor was able to prove, or rather convince the jury, that not only had he willfully engaged in risky sexual practices, but that he'd actually intended to kill these women.
And you interviewed him in jail after the verdict. Did he show any remorse?
No, he showed none. And this again sort of went to in the court case. You know, he was interviewed by psychologists and so on, and the psychologist had great difficulty getting him to even talk about the offenses for which he was charged. He just wanted to talk about his own life and his own experiences, and he showed no remorse. And with me, certainly, I tried to prod him a little bit. You know, I asked him how he felt about the women who had died, and he reacted almost with surprise and disgust that I was even broaching the topic. I asked him how he felt about the women who had died, and he said, I'm a human being, I have a heart, and he started to get angry at me and gave me the finger through the glass on the other side of the interview cubicle in jail. And he said, and you know, in these words I used in my story, I thought it spoke volumes. He said, I come from Africa where all these people are dying, and you want to ask me about this? You know, as though the death of these two women just didn't seem to register with him. So no, I gave him opportunity, and there was no remorse at all.
And what's the situation of the other seven women who are infected?
They, I'm not sure of their health status at the current moment. You know, there were four other women who he had sex with, who he was also charged with attempted assault. You know, they weren't infected. The ones who were infected, they're receiving treatment, I gather, and hopefully they're doing okay. Only two women have, only two of the dozens of women he had sex with have died, and you know, police officers here interviewed them on their deathbeds to get statements from them about their relationships with Johnson Aziga, and those are the two deaths for which he was charged.
And as I understand from reading your piece, he had a very rare form of HIV, which made it relatively easy for the Crown, the prosecution, to say this person infected these women.
That's right. The a rare strain called clade A. There's some confusion as to where he contracted it, if it was in Africa or in Ontario once he moved here with refugee status. But yes, it's quite a fascinating story in the sense that, you know, the lead detective was going back and forth between a lab in Ottawa and the Ministry of Health in Ontario with samples. Blood samples from the women and from Aziga to see if the strains matched. And when they had a match, as you say, it made it pretty clear that he was the one who had infected them.
What do you think? Do you think this was murder?
I do. You know, it was interesting. When I interviewed the lead detective, I always felt that, you know, there was a pretty big hurdle that the prosecution of the Crown was asking the jury to go over in terms of proving intent. You know, you could prove that he was careless, that he was neglectful, you know, and that uncaring. But can you prove that he meant to kill these people? And the detective said to me that he felt, you know, that Aziga had gone through this stormy divorce. His wife had custody of his children. He was angry at his God, angry at his life, and that he was a man looking for payback. He was looking to hurt people. And then, you know, the real damning thing for him in the case was that, you know, he actually had a couple of these women calling him from hospital to say they'd been infected. You know, are you positive? Did you test positive? And he kept saying no. So, you know, the Crown kept...
Well, wait. So after they found out they were HIV positive, they were getting in touch with him to inform him.
Yes. And this was the crux that, you know, in the end, the Crown was able to show that, you know, in fact, he had opportunity to help these women to say, well, yes, I was positive, you know, and to encourage them to continue with their treatment and to get proper attention, that sort of thing. And he still denied it, and he still willfully sort of ignored him, and that this was the disregard for what happened to them. He chose to do nothing, as the Crown said. And so I think that's what gets intent, that not just that he had sex with these women and carried about his business and had issues that way, but that he willfully didn't inform them, and when he knew he was infecting them, he didn't tell these women that he was positive. He was content, it appears, to let them die. And so, yes, I think that's a murder.
John Wells, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
John Wells, a reporter for the Hamilton Spectator, the author of 3 true crime books. You can find a link to his interview with Johnson Aziga on our website at npr.org. And Regan Hoffman joins us now. She's editor-in-chief of Pause Magazine, a publication for people living with and infected by AIDS. She's with us from our bureau in New York. She wrote an op-ed about her feelings about the Aziga case. It appeared in the Daily Beast, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you, Neil. Thanks for having me on the show.
And as you listened to, and I know you read about this case too, you did not think this was murder.
No, that's not what I said. I do think that Aziga was an egregious and exceptional case. I think people who know that they have HIV and who willfully, with intent, try to harm other people and transmit HIV should be punished. I've never said otherwise. What I had said in my piece or tried to convey was that is it's an exceptional case, and the majority of cases of criminalization of people living with HIV today are not quite as dramatic nor clear cut, and that has a sort of bigger impact on society. Obviously, when someone does something terrible, we want to punish them, but if we're trying to stop the spread of HIV and reduce the public health threat of HIV, criminalizing people with the disease actually backfires because it prevents people from talking about it, from getting tested, and from getting onto care, which actually, if you are on antiretroviral medication, it lowers your viral load and can make you less infectious. So therefore, regardless of your behavior, you might be less of a threat to other people. But the point also I think we have to remember is that Aziga's case is one in, you know, there are 1.2 million people living with HIV in America who know their HIV status. About a quarter of them are estimated to not know their HIV status, and that's where the majority of new infections are coming from, people who don't know their status. Mm-hmm. So how are we going to solve that? Well, we've got to get people to get tested. Well, criminalizing people with HIV is not going to make anybody want to get tested for HIV.
And when you're talking about criminalizing the HIV transmission, what are you talking about if not Joseph Aziga?
Well, I think people who, again, who are aware of their HIV status and do not disclose, I think there should be, I think there should be laws to protect people from that kind of behavior. But again, the law is very complicated. It's very muddy. It's different in different states, and it's increasingly becoming easier, I think, for people to be prosecuted for non-disclosure. And there are a lot of things that are difficult to prove. For example, let's say these women found out that they were HIV positive, and there's not an overwhelming amount of forensic information in a lot of the cases where we can actually link a person who's bringing a case like this to court. In his case, in fact, there was. It's often more complicated, and it comes down to a he said, she said, or he said, she said, she said.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very difficult thing to prove, and given the hysteria around HIV, it's tricky. And my other issue with criminalizing HIV is that if we're going to do that, then let's be fair. Let's also criminalize people who do not disclose that they have HPV, human papillomavirus, another sexually transmitted virus that can lead to certain strains of cancer that can be deadly. And let's perhaps consider people who knowingly have swine flu and get on a bus or an airplane. Let's be consistent in the application of the law if we're going to start criminalizing people for spreading disease when they know that they have it.
And as you look at these cases, clearly in a case like Mr. Aziga, or if it was a rape that was involved, not consensual sex, then that would certainly qualify for criminal penalties.
Well, on several accounts, I would think. But
yeah.
And you know, I interestingly, though, I was on another radio show discussing the same topic, and I got calls from several women who, in fact, had been raped. Check this out. So they had been raped. They were HIV positive. They did not tell the They told the policeman that they had disclosed to the person because they didn't want to be put in jail for not disclosing to their assailant. They were concerned that they might, in fact, be put behind bars. And I have also heard from HIV-positive women who were raped who were so concerned about the well-being of their assailant that they wanted to make sure that the person was given exposure to post-exposure prophylaxis or treatment that you can take within 72 hours of being exposed to HIV, which can prevent the transmission. So here's a woman who's been raped protecting her assailant. She's HIV-positive. Should she go to jail?
Let's get some more calls in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Our guest is Regan Hoffman, editor-in-chief of PAWS magazine, a publication for people living with and affected by AIDS. And if you'd like to join us again, 800-989-8255. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about whether people who knowingly spread HIV should go to prison. We especially want to hear from those of you with HIV. What's your experience? Do you fully disclose your status with every partner every time? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation on our website, too, npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Our guest is Regan Hoffman, editor-chief at PAWS magazine, and recently wrote an opinion piece for the Daily Beast titled, Should People Who Spread HIV Go to Jail? Let's see if we get a caller on the line. And this is Prince. Prince with us from Sacramento.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
I'm good. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Well, you know, I definitely think they should be put in the jail. I personally live with HIV, and when I found out, it was one of those situations where I had to decide whether or not I was going to basically just tell my sexual partner, or if I was going to, like, basically, like, you know, plaster it on my shirt and, like, tell the world that I had HIV. And what happened was is that rumors just started flying within the gay community. I'm gay.
Mm-hmm.
And that I had it among friends and that I wasn't telling people. And that was so hurtful to me because I was. And so I just decided, you know, probably like months ago to just basically put it on my MySpace, on my Facebook, and tell everyone about it. And that, for me, it's made a big difference in being comfortable with it. It's actually turned out I've been able to help a lot of my friends come out that they have HIV and to talk about it and, you know, talk about treatment and things of that sort. So I've kind of become like the, you know, Dr. Oz of, you know, my group.
Do you know how you got it, Prince?
I do. From my ex-boyfriend, he did not know he had HIV and we were together. And that, you know, it's kind of sad because, you know, he called me after we had broken up, about 3 months after we broke up, and we had gotten pregnant while we were together, and we did not use protection the entire relationship. And he told me that I should go get tested because he found out that he had it. And I went and got tested, and that was definitely a life-changing doctor's appointment. And I, you know, it's, in the end, though, it's everyone's own responsibility, to take care of their health. And we shouldn't put that up on someone else. But I think if someone's going out and maliciously trying to affect other people, you know, they should be prosecuted.
And Regan Hoffman, that last point is something that you make in your piece as well, that in terms of consensual sex where somebody doesn't know that they're HIV positive, well, it's clearly both parties' responsibility.
Yes, I think I tell everybody that I'm HIV positive from the beginning, obviously. But at the same time, I would expect everyone who's having unprotected sex to know that there's always a risk. Even if you ask your partner, have you been tested for HIV, and the person had been tested that morning, they possibly could have contracted HIV in, you know, recent past history, and their body might not yet have had a chance to produce the antibodies that would mean that they would then have a mm-hmm. positive HIV positive test. So people may not be lying to you. There's always risk. If you're having unprotected sex, no matter what, you are at risk for HIV and a lot of things. And everybody has to take individual responsibility for that. And everybody who's ever had unprotected sex has the obligation to go out and get tested so that they're not spreading HIV unwillingly or unknowingly to other people.
Prince, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm over the period of the shock and, you know, feeling when you first find out, you know, you think you're going to die in a month. So, and then you get educated on it, and you try to help your friends who do have it, and try to encourage other people in my group to make sure they use protection, because everyone thinks it just doesn't happen because we're young.
Prince, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And you were going to come in there, Regan? I'm sorry?
Yeah, I was just going to make a point. First of all, I applaud Prince. I think that's great. And I think people really have a misperception around people with HIV. Most people living with HIV wouldn't give this virus to their worst enemy. We live with it. We know how difficult it is to survive it, despite the advances in medical treatment. It's a very, very difficult disease to endure. And most people will go to extreme lengths to protect anyone that they're with. So again, we're seeing in the media these exceptional cases, these fringe cases of people that are arguably fill in the blank, and then that's forming public opinion and I think tainting the view of what HIV-positive people are like. Most HIV-positive people would not want to hurt people with this virus. In fact, the opposite.
We'll take more calls in a minute, but we're interested in some of the legal issues that were raised by this case and others around people being brought to court for transmission of HIV. Jonathan Turley joins us now. He's a professor of public interest law at George Washington University. He's also in our New York bureau. Nice to have you back in the program.
Hi, Neil.
And the Aziga case took 5 years to get to court. And I was interested in that question John Wells was talking to us about earlier, the difficulty of proving intent in this case.
Well, that is one of the fascinating aspects of these cases. I've been following these cases on my blog for years now because they present a very, in some ways, intractable problem for the law. Unlike that case where you had a rare strain that could be just in terms of the percentage likelihood associated with him, most of these cases can't be traced in that way. We had a recent case in Texas of Philippe Padu, who was a martial arts instructor who would go to swingers clubs. And he infected six women. One developed full-blown AIDS. And he – one of his defenses was, in fact, how could you show that I was the one that gave these people AIDS if they had very – or some of them had very active sexual mm-hmm. lives? It is a difficult question. It's made more difficult by the fact that there are 21 states that have what are called HIV laws. Now, stopping there for a second, that doesn't mean that the other states do not prosecute the cases. It's just that they do it under more conventional statutes. Texas is one of those states that simply charges people with murder or assault. But the 21 states that have HIV laws are just absolutely incredibly different. I was really shocked when I first went into these statutes how different the standards were. You have cases, states like California that explicitly requires intent. And then on the other extent, end of the spectrum, you've got states like Iowa that doesn't require any specific intent. You've got states like Missouri where it's not a defense to wear a condom. And you can actually be tried and prosecuted under these laws for biting someone, even though the science runs heavily against that type of theory. So these states are all over the board. And many of the statutes are not well crafted. Some of them were crafted before a lot of the science came out. And the result is a lot of confusion.
There's a case, I think, in New Mexico where a man was charged with aggravated battery with a deadly weapon after he spat on a police officer. And again, that the science doesn't go there and it might seem a hard case to prove.
Well, if that was Willie Campbell, he got 35 years for that, which is just a complete disconnect between the law and the science. It is shown that there's a very low likelihood that you can actually become HIV positive from exposure to saliva.
Very low, close to vanishingly small positive.
That's right. Yeah. And there's also plenty of science that shows that if you wear a condom, it reduces the chances of transmission by, I believe, over 90%. So you have this situation where the law reacted very powerfully after what was called the Reagan Commission in 1987. And that's what set a lot of these laws in motion. Mm. And a lot of what happened in 1987, by the way, is that people had specific characters in mind, particularly a person by the name of Gayton Dugas, who was in the book, the famous work, And the Band Played On. Mm-hmm. And in the piece, he was identified as patient zero, that they thought that he was one of an early principal spreaders of the disease. And in the book, it talks about how he would have sex with people and then allegedly tell them, I've got the gay cancer. This is a direct quote. I'm going to die and so are you. And accounts like that really hit in 1987, and the commission demanded criminal laws to deal with these individuals. And I think what Reagan is saying is that, and I think she's right, if you look at these cases, there are very few people. I mean, these are monsters. I mean, really true monsters. And there's very few of them.
Mr. Aziga interestingly used that word about himself. Anyway, let's get some more callers on the line. Let's go to Martha. Martha with us from Southport, Connecticut.
Hi. I'm really glad this case has come to the attention because I think it needs to be brought out the discussion. We know from statistics that a very high incidence, an increase, higher incidence, as a matter of fact, of HIV infection is amongst men, and particularly white men over the age of 45. It's not younger people. And I do think that it's going to bring that out in to the wider public, which it ought to, and perhaps people will consider, I mean, because an awful lot of people are put under the pressure of this idea that one shouldn't worry about the risk. And oftentimes, and someone else mentioned, I think it was Reagan, HP or human papillomavirus.
Yes.
Well, that used to be contracted, usually was brought home, unfortunately, by husbands who were stray. And so women would be infected, and then they would have cervical cancer. So I do think that this is a worthy discussion, and I'm glad it's being brought out because there is no-fault divorce, and I'm waiting to see, you know, what comes of this as far as the legal repercussions in a divorce situation where the wife is infected.
Reagan, is she right on her statistics?
Just about. Although we do see a high number of new infections among young people, half of all new infections are among people under the age of 30. So, but she's right to say that this is a disease that has no idea how old you are, whether you're gay or straight, black or white. It just doesn't know. It's a biological element. It moves anywhere nature allows it. And one of the biggest problems we have around the world is that people continue to misperceive who is at risk for HIV. Promiscuity, for example, is not necessary for one to get HIV. We believe that you can become pregnant through one act of unprotected sex, but for some reason people don't think you can, you know, become HIV positive from one act of unprotected sex. And in fact, she's also right that marriage is actually considered a high risk factor around the world, including in the United States, because often married couples don't use condoms. So absolutely, we have more infections and more people living with HIV on the planet and in America than ever before in history. Your mathematical odds of contracting HIV today are greater than they have ever been. So this is not over. And unfortunately, this is a terrible way to bring it up with Aziga's case. But again, if the net outcome is that people realize that this is very much still a risk and they take care to protect themselves, then perhaps it is a helpful conversation.
And Jonathan, Jonathan Turley, are you aware of this coming up in divorce proceedings?
Well, it has come up in divorce proceedings. It's also come up in a lot of different ways. As you probably know, until recently, cases of this kind were dealt with in torts. That is, people would simply seek damages. And we've seen a lot of those cases. And by the way, there's a whole area of STDs, also pregnancy cases, where people have sued saying – where they said that they could not get pregnant and it was untrue and they knew it was untrue. And then they end up being sued. And in some of those cases, they're sued for battery on the civil side, a very close analogy to the criminal side. We also had a case recently in Illinois where a woman sued the parents of her husband. Because he ended up dying and no one in the family told her that he was HIV positive, and she ended up suing them. So there's a great array of these civil cases.
Mm. Martha, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking about the transmission of HIV and criminality. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go next to Paul. Paul with us from Kansas City.
Yes, hi.
Go ahead, please.
My history with HIV goes way back to the early 80s when hardly any of us knew what was going on. I lost my first partner. I fortunately was not infected. He had it when I first met him, but didn't know it. And at that time, in those early years, when there was so much HIV going around, no one really thought in terms of victim versus perpetrator. It was assumed that everyone could have contracted this, and that everyone had to take equal responsibility for taking care of themselves. And over the years, it's been interesting for me to observe a whole sort of victim versus perpetrator mentality emerge. And I don't understand why these women who engage in unprotected sex are somehow considered innocent victims when they have engaged in this sex, fully aware that such a risk always exists in unprotected sex.
Regan Hoffman, would you agree that the women in, for example, the Aziga case, and that's what Paul's talking about, I guess, are victims, or are they responsible to some degree?
Well, I think everyone's responsible for what happens to their own body to a degree, especially in this case when it was consensual sex. I was infected by someone who did not know his HIV status, and I thought all the right questions. I evaluated him and in terms of what I could, but ultimately I rolled the dice. Even if there was a 0.0001% chance that he was lying to me or that he was unaware of his HIV status, that is a reality. And so I engaged in consensual unprotected sex, and I took a risk. And I do take some responsibility for that. And I don't think that all the responsibility should fall back to the HIV-positive person. Everyone should be responsible for themselves. But again, I do think in the case of these exceptional monsters, we have to find a way to deal with them. Mm. But I think, again, what we want to do is get people to not fear knowing their HIV status, to encourage people to get tested, because if you have HIV, the earlier you find out that you have the disease, the better your health care can be and the longer your life can be. And we can prevent future infections because we can educate people, and often people, when they know their status, are far less likely to transmit the virus to other people. Yes. So anything that we can do as a society to destigmatize the disease, to encourage people to look at this as just another disease. It's simply a disease, nothing more, nothing less. We've wrapped it in a cauldron of other things, but it is just science, and we can beat this sucker if we look at it like that.
Thanks, yeah, Paul.
I completely agree with you, and I did not mean that as a personal.
No, I understand that. Paul. Thank you very much for the call. Let's see, we squeeze one last caller in. This is Mark. Mark calling from Phoenix.
Yeah, I became HIV positive in the late 80s while I was in a monogamous relationship, and what's interesting is my physician was a friend of both of ours, and he knew my partner was positive. And he, because of confidentiality, couldn't disclose.
Ooh.
What do you do in these situations?
And your partner obviously knew he was positive, too.
That's correct.
And what did you do?
I became positive. And I've been living a very healthy life, thank God. But it is kind of interesting because I think doctors are put in a position that they have to be respecting a person's privacy, especially with all the new HIPAA laws, yet they have knowledge that could be helpful to a partner.
Jonathan Turley, any thoughts here?
Well, we have encountered this problem in other areas. There's a famous case called Tarasov, where a psychiatrist knew that a patient had violent thoughts towards a young woman and did not take steps beyond an initial call to the local campus police. He was at the University of California, and he went out and murdered her. And what the court said was that he actually could be held civilly liable. He could be forced to pay damages for not doing more. And indeed, this doctor could be challenged about what he failed to do because he was aware of someone who might be in the position of being physically harmed. Now, there are federal privacy laws, but at a minimum, he should have confronted the other patient and said, I won't be your doctor unless you make this disclosure.
Mark, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I'd like to thank our guest, Jonathan Turley, professor of public interest law at George Washington University, with us from our bureau in New York. Also there, Regan Hoffman, editor-in-chief of Pause Magazine, a publication for those living with and affected by AIDS. Her book, I Have Something to Tell You, will be published in September. Good luck with that, and thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, Christopher Hitchens joins us to mark 60 years of Big Brother, Thought Police in 1984. Stay with us. This is NPR News.